This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we hear from Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin about the SHIELD Act to be voted on today.
If a foreign power or foreign agent comes to you with, you know, information on your political opponent, you must report that to the FBI.
We'll also hear about the future of medicine. Telehealth is coming.
There's always a population of folks that prefer to come in. That's important. And one of the reasons why telehealth is always left as an option rather than a mandatory way of delivering care.
We'll hear about Michigan's first governor and how many times his body has been moved around. And a discussion about climate change. Andrew Hoffman says it's more than new technology. It has to be a culture shift.
The Tesla is a great car, but it's still a car. And the answer is not more cars.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Bills in both houses of Congress would require political campaigns to notify the government if a foreign national or an agent of a foreign power offers to help the campaign. This comes after the Senate Intelligence Committee called for congressional action on this issue. Representative Alyssa Slotkin is a Democrat from Michigan's 8th Congressional District, and she's a sponsor of what's being called the SHIELD Act. That stands for Stopping Harmful Interference in Elections for a Lasting Democracy, and it will be voted on later today. Representative Slotkin joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get some background. What did the Senate Intelligence Committee find that prompted it to call for a congressional action?
Well, I think there's been, I think the SHIELD Act, which we're putting forward and voting on this week, is not something that came specifically just from any one committee suggesting it. I think it came from an acknowledgement from people across the political spectrum that foreigners should not be able to muck around in our election systems, right? Either in our actual voting systems or in our political process. So we put forward the SHIELD Act. A couple of bills that I was the original co-sponsor on have been incorporated into this act. A lot of pieces are actually very bipartisan, which I'm really proud of. And it does a whole bunch of things. One of them is, as you mentioned, you know, if a foreign power or foreign agent comes to you with, you know, information on your political opponent, you must report that to the FBI. That's a component of this bill. There's other great pieces. I'm happy to walk you through it. But
yeah, that's what we're looking for. I mean, we wanted that broad overview. But, you know, as you say, part of the SHIELD Act is your work. What did you include in this package?
Yeah. So number one, what was originally called the FIRE Act. So if someone comes to you, a foreigner, offering information on your opponent, or anyone, you got to come report it to the FBI. Number two, on advertisements, political advertisements. I think Democrats, Republicans, independents can all agree that we don't believe that foreigners should be buying ads for or against a candidate in the U.S. political system. This one's particularly important to Michigan because we know we were really targeted in 2016 with these Russian-purchased ads. The next part is that you can't exchange campaign information with foreigners. So polling data or, you know, political insight, that's something we shouldn't be sharing with foreigners. We can't share them with other political groups often, so you shouldn't share them with foreigners. And then lastly, you can't mislead people on how to actually vote. We know from things that happened in North Carolina, things that happened in Texas, they were groups that were organized around just confusing people on how they could actually vote on election day.
The larger issue of foreign disinformation, a lot of that's spread on social media. Most of those who share those memes and information don't understand that it is foreign disinformation.
Yeah.
When you have a sizable portion of the American electorate actively participating in spreading this disinformation, how do you stop that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a couple of things. In this bill, we actually call for disclosure requirements. So I want there to be a little label at the bottom of anything that's paid for by a foreigner. You know, if they're doing just a general, you know, issue ad, you know, talking about the environment or talking about, you know, gun issues, I want there to be a little label at the bottom of that Facebook post that says this was purchased by a foreigner. And therefore, before someone forwards it, hopefully they read the disclaimer and say, huh, I don't want to be involved in spreading foreign purchased information. That doesn't sound good to me. So there's all kinds of disclosure requirements. And I think that's really important. The other thing that I co-sponsored, a separate bill that's on digital education, you know, helping our kids understand how to look at this new media and discern what's really kind of truth and what's not, who to trust, who not to trust. And I think that, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, we just didn't have this need to learn and understand what we're being presented with on social media. And I think that it's high time that our kids be educated, since they're going to be in an all-digital world.
I want to tap your former expertise. You're a former CIA analyst. You also worked in other aspects of national security. Given that, what are your biggest concerns about foreign influence on American elections that would not occur to the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, to me, what really helped me from my previous life is I've seen this strategy before, particularly by the Russians. You know, when I was at the Pentagon, I dealt a lot with the Russians, and we used to watch them try and interfere and influence the political processes in other countries. I used to watch it in Eastern Europe. And they had a pretty simple playbook. And their playbook was, you sow dissent among the citizens of, let's say, a place like Romania or, you know, an Eastern European country. You put out information that has, you know, Romanian political parties at each other's throats, because if the Romanians are distracted amongst each other, then they won't spend as much time wondering what the heck Russia is doing in their country, and what kind of things Russia is doing in their near abroad. And what I have seen from my previous life is that the Russians in particular are trying to apply that same strategy at a much bigger scale here in the United States and in places like Michigan. If Americans are polarized, if we're arguing and fighting with each other, then we don't realize that Russia is attempting to really make some important gains militarily. They're attempting to sort of reclaim their superpower status. And I'm not saying they're perfect at it. They're certainly ham-handed sometimes. But I have seen this movie before just in Eastern Europe.
This vote on the SHIELD Act is to take place amidst a very tense moment in the House. The partisan divide is intense because of the ongoing impeachment inquiry. Is there real bipartisan support for the SHIELD Act in the House and, for that matter, in the Senate?
So there's definitely bipartisan support for a bunch of the bills that are contained in the SHIELD Act. I co-sponsored a bill about the ads, about, you know, preventing foreigners from buying ads for or against a candidate with Representative Elise Stefanik from upstate New York, who's a Republican. So there are definitely bipartisan pieces. Unfortunately, Republican leadership is pushing pretty hard for their members to vote against this bill. I hope that's not the case. I hope that some brave Republicans see that this shouldn't be a partisan issue. But what I hope and what I'm recommending to my leadership is that let's pass this giant SHIELD Act. And then let's break apart the pieces that are truly bipartisan and introduce them as separate bills, so that if someone isn't comfortable voting on the entirety of the SHIELD Act, if my Republican colleagues don't feel comfortable, that maybe there are four or five pieces that they do feel comfortable with. And I'm a pragmatist. Something is better than nothing. And if there's bipartisan things that can go all the way through the Senate and be signed into law, that's what I want to focus on.
Well, let's talk about that a little more. I mean, while Congress is working to stop foreign influence in elections, President Donald Trump recently asked China to investigate political opponents. Testimony during a hearing yesterday was called damning by many members of Congress. It indicated President Trump did want to hold up funding to Ukraine until the Ukrainian president publicly stated he would investigate a company connected to presidential candidate Joe Biden's son. If I were a Republican in Congress and a supporter of Donald Trump, the SHIELD Act would seem to be putting me in an awkward spot. What are they saying?
Well, to be honest, we've been working on the broad pieces of the SHIELD Act since we got sworn into Congress. So I first introduced one of the pieces of the SHIELD Act back in the winter. So long before the conversation on impeachment inquiry was really as live as it is now. I hope that my Republican colleagues see this as separate and distinct, and I hope that they, you know, do their duty and they swore an oath just like I did to protect and defend the Constitution. And we can't let our democratic processes be influenced by foreigners. And that goes for Russians today. It could go for Iranians, as we know, as reported, you know, have been trying to muck around in our political process. It can go for any foreign group now and into the future, regardless of president and who the president is. So I've been talking to some of my Republican colleagues. I think many of them want to vote for it, and we'll get a chance to see how they turn out in the next couple of hours.
If the SHIELD Act or part of the act passes, will President Trump sign it?
I don't know. I wouldn't deign to know. I think most importantly is it's got to go over to Senator McConnell, and I very much hope the Senate gives it an up or down vote. We've had a problem getting our bills through the Senate. And I know that lots of bills that come over from the Democratic House are not going to pass the Republican Senate. I'm a realist, but I just believe they are owed an up or down vote. That's all. And I would say that whether we had a Democratic, majority leader or a Republican majority leader, when Harry Reid wasn't pushing bills through the House of through the Senate, when he was the Democratic Senate leader, that wasn't right either. And I think an up or down vote for some of these really important bills that protect our elections should be the bare minimum of living up to our duty to defend and protect the Constitution.
If the SHIELD Act does become law, will it end the problem of foreign interference in American elections, or are there further steps that need to take place?
So I think there's always more that we are going to need to do, only because media is changing so quickly, technology is changing so quickly, and that's a very difficult thing to do, protect our most valued democratic system as the world just changes around us so quickly. A lot of the SHIELD Act is actually just updating laws that came into effect when we had like the advent of TV, right? It was like, oh, Lord, we have a new technology. It's called television. And we want to make sure our election systems don't have foreigners buying ads on TV in an election. Well, this is just updating a lot of kind of outdated standards. And I think it's just going to be an ongoing challenge. In Michigan, we're blessed to have Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. She is an expert at this, at protecting our Michigan elections. But we're going to need to be vigilant as technology changes around us.
Alyssa Slotkin represents Michigan's 8th Congressional District. She is a sponsor of the SHIELD Act, which aims to stop foreign influences in U.S. elections. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Coming up, we'll talk with the Michigan History Center about the not-so-final resting place of Michigan's boy governor, Stevens T. Mason.
They sort of petitioned to have Stevens T. removed from his burial place in New York and brought back to Detroit.
That's after the break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday. That means it's time to hear about our state's history with the Michigan History Center.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
For most people, when they die and they are buried, it's considered their final resting place. That's not always the case. Michigan's first governor has been buried a few times. To explain about that, we're joined by the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Hi there.
Hi.
So Stevens T. Mason was acting governor of the Michigan Territory off and on. He was the chief force pushing for Michigan statehood. The big sticking point at that time was the Toledo War. What was that all about?
The Toledo War was an argument between Michigan and Ohio over who actually controlled Toledo and the port around Toledo. The original thinking was Michigan's southern border would be straight across from the bottom of Lake Michigan, and if that was the case, then Toledo would be ours. But Ohio had already been a state, and they had already had all of their maps done, so they claimed Toledo. And so there was a quote-unquote war, a lot of posturing at the border, militia forces sent in. And finally, in the end, Michigan had to cede Toledo, and we received the rest of the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, Congress just gave us the western part of the Upper Peninsula. Mason was elected the first governor of the state. How old was he?
He was young. He was only 24 years old when he was the territorial governor. And yeah, he was super young.
Yeah, that's a record that's still held, right? The youngest governor ever?
I believe so, yes.
They called him the boy governor, which I'm sure he appreciated that.
He did not care for that.
We should note, by the way, this coming Sunday will be Stevens T. Mason's 208th birthday.
Yes.
Which is
happy birthday.
Yeah. What kind of governor was Stevens T. Mason?
It depends who you ask. History has treated him a little bit better than his record immediately after he was governor. But he saw Michigan through statehood. We had a lot of financial issues as we were trying to become a state, and he was sort of instrumental in getting us going. He brought in railroads and canal systems in order to get people into the state and moving here from the east. However, he was also instrumental and responsible for removing tens of thousands of indigenous peoples off their land. So it really depends on who you ask, but he pushed statehood forward quite quickly for Michigan.
There was a depression called the Panic of 1837, and that economic downturn hit Michigan especially hard, mm-hmm. which kind of sounds familiar, right?
Yes.
Governor Mason became pretty unpopular because he supported the state borrowing a lot of money for the improvements you talked about, the mm-hmm. roads, the railroads, canals. So he didn't run for reelection. What happened to him after that?
He ended up leaving the state. He was incredibly unpopular at the end of his term, and people really blamed him for the financial crisis of 37. So he returned to New York, and he attempted to become a lawyer. His father-in-law had a practice there, and he tried to get into that practice. But he ended up catching pneumonia and dying in New York in early 1843.
So he's a very young man.
Yes, he was.
So he was buried in New York. Then a guy named Lawton T. Hemans, is that mm-hmm. how you say his name?
Yes, it is.
He wrote a biography about Mason. He thought the governor ought to be brought home.
Yeah.
What happened?
In 1905, there was a commission to return the body of Stevens T. Mason. And I think that's actually what the commission was called. And Hemans was made the head of that commission. And so they sort of petitioned to have Stevens T. removed from his burial place in New York and brought back to Detroit. They thought that he should be buried in honor in Detroit at the site of the former Capitol.
Yeah, today what is the Capitol Square Park.
Yes.
Lots of people there, I understand.
Yes, yeah. There were a lot of people welcoming back home. By 1905, again, history treats Stevens T. a little bit better than his contemporaries did. So by 1905, he was seen as sort of a hero of Michigan's history.
So he's at rest in Michigan in 1905. There was even a statue, life-size statue of him erected above his grave in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the mid-1950s, he was kind of unceremoniously moved again. Why?
There were road improvements and improvements that need to be made to the park. And so they had to move him so they could make these road improvements. So he was moved and stored for a little while during this road project. And then he was put back in Capitol Park.
In 2010, Governor Stevens T. Mason was once again moved after they finally found where he was buried. Why was he moved this time?
Roadwork. Again, they had to make improvements and expansions to the area, the road in the area around the park. And they knew he was there. And so they knew that they were going to have to get him and move him. But as you said, when they went to go look for him, it took them a little longer than they expected to find him. It didn't take, you know, news reports made it sound like they lost him for quite a bit of time, but it was only a few hours. But he just wasn't exactly where they thought he was. So they did find him. And he actually laid in state in the Capitol building for a little while during that project. So they brought him back to Lansing, where he sat in the Capitol Rotunda. And he was honored there as sort of a, I don't want to say an apology, but an acknowledgement for what he contributed to the state. And then he was brought back to Detroit and put back in Capitol Park.
That's quite a post-mortem history. I know the inscription on the base of Mason's statue in Detroit notes that his ashes lie beneath, but do you think most people today actually know who Stevens T. Mason was and that he was buried in an area of Detroit that's in the midst of this big redevelopment going on in downtown?
That's hard to say. There are a lot of people coming into Detroit as part of sort of Detroit's renaissance, if you want to call it that. And I imagine a lot of people don't know who he was. My hometown is named after him, and I think a lot of people probably don't know that the Mason, Michigan is named after Stevens T. Mason. But I think that a lot of people don't realize he's there unless they stop and actually, you know, read the inscription. And I'm that person that stops and reads everything, much to my family's chagrin.
Well, good for
but
you.
But I imagine
me too.
A lot of people, especially newer people to Detroit and younger people don't know. So hopefully they go and read it.
It's at the Capitol Park, which is a nicely done. When they re-landscaped it, it really, really turned out nicely, I think.
Yes, it looks really nice.
I would like a little more grass, but, you know, it's an urban area, right? It's right downtown in the city. Rachel Clark is with the Michigan History Center. Thanks for telling us about Stevens T. Mason.
Thank you very much, and happy birthday to him.
Stateside wants to know what you think are the important stories we should check out. What issues should we be looking into? Let us know. Our email is stateside@michiganradio.org. Or you can find us on Facebook, just search for Michigan Radio. And we're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and again at michiganradio.org. Just click on that link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. We use online communications for all kinds of purposes, some important, some kind of frivolous. The medical community has been looking at online communication to treat patients who live far away or who are in an underserved area. But it's tricky. There are concerns about acceptance. There are concerns about insurance coverage. There are concerns about privacy and security risks. Joining us to talk about online healthcare is Dr. Chad Elimudel. He's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan and a member of the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. He's also the director of telehealth for the urology department at U of M. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
That's
Thank
a lot of titles, me. By the way.
Yeah, stay busy.
All right. First, let's start with some basic stuff. What is telehealth? Just a video link or are patients' vitals communicated live? What does it do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the definition has changed over time. But more broadly, for all intents and purposes, telehealth is defined as using telecommunications technology to diagnose, manage, and treat human disease. And so the telehealth is also synonymous with telemedicine, with virtual care, digital health, e-health, all those words are kind of used interchangeably. And so telehealth includes really any form of telecommunications technology. So it could include using a telephone to communicate with a patient. It could include using a patient portal messaging system, could include live video conferencing or using wearables to check vitals.
So why did we need this? What's wrong with some face-to-face contact?
Oh, absolutely nothing wrong with face-to-face contact. And I think there's a lot of context and need for face-to-face contact. I think one of the things that is occurring in our society is that we're using a lot more of a lot more telecommunications for every other aspect of our society. So there's some limitations to the standard way that patients are seen in clinics. And so telehealth offers an improvement in efficiency of care, which is much needed for our healthcare system.
I'm part of the baby boomer generation, and some of my older colleagues in this cohort are not always really up to speed on things like this. What's the acceptance been like on dealing with this?
Yeah, the acceptance has actually been great. And I think that it was a common misconception that, so I've been conducting video consultations with patients since 2016. And it's a common misconception that the older generation is going to try to avoid it. But what we found is that there's a lot of reasons that the older generation likes it. And number one is that they're much more familiar with technology than they have been in the past. I have a lot of patients that FaceTime with their grandkids, and so they're familiar with it. Number two is that sometimes they have even more limitations than younger generations to get into clinics, in terms of transportation and so forth. And so for those reasons, it's been used. And I'd say one more reason is that they tend to have more appointments with healthcare providers than younger folks too. So I think for all those reasons, it's been pretty well accepted. There's always a population of folks that prefer to come in, and I think that that's important. And one of the reasons why telehealth is always left as an option rather than a mandatory way of delivering care.
At the same time, there are some pretty underserved areas in the state of Michigan, especially when it comes to specialized care like yours. How important is it in serving that population that isn't near a specialist.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that that's the sort of the biggest win for telehealth is being able to connect patients that are in rural areas to specialists. And so there's some patients, I'm a physician at University of Michigan, so there's some patients that come to see me from 8 hours away. And sometimes after an eight-hour drive, they're essentially having a 15-minute consultation with me and then driving 8 hours back. And so there's a lot of opportunity for telehealth to remove that distance and to connect patients to the to physicians and other healthcare providers more easily.
You talked about a number of different media to connect with a patient that's off-site. What are the limits of diagnosing a patient via online video or on telephone or any other kind of communication method?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think that the limitations are really about the clinical condition. There's some conditions that in every specialty, there's some conditions that we frankly don't need a physical exam for. I'll give you a good example. I treat kidney stones. And so the majority of my treatment decisions about kidney stones are around what does it look like on a CT scan? And then I talk to the patient about the operation that they need. There are other reasons why, there are many other conditions where a patient needs to come in, and mainly if they need a physical exam or if they need a diagnostic procedure that's performed in the office. And so my greater vision with telehealth is that we eventually it's so well integrated into our healthcare system that we eventually reach a point where in-person care is actually option B. So if option A would be option A would be some sort of virtual connection, but the patient only needing to come in if they are meeting a physician for the first time or they need a diagnostic test or they need a physical exam.
We mentioned insurance or other kind of healthcare coverage. Who covers telehealth and similar systems and who does not?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And so interestingly, telehealth has been covered by major payers, including the Medicare program, for decades. It really has been around for a long time. The problem is that there has been a barrier to how that reimbursement occurs. And the idea is that initially when Medicare was covering telehealth, they required patients to they couldn't connect from home, and they needed to travel to a medical facility, and that medical facility needed to be in a health professional shortage area. So even though it's been around for such a long time, less than 1% of rural Medicare patients have ever used a telehealth service. And so that speaks a lot to how big that barrier was, even though it was reimbursed. So what we're seeing now is that there's been a dramatic change in the way that policymakers are viewing telehealth. And so they're viewing telehealth as an important part of healthcare delivery. And so major commercial payers in the state of Michigan have started to cover video consultations from home, actually at the same rate as an in-person visit. So that's changed a lot of momentum. At the national level, the Medicare program has re-examined its historical policies on coverage. And in 2020, Medicare Advantage patients will be able to connect from home. And there's a lot of momentum to move original Medicare patients in that direction too. So a lot of behaviors in healthcare tend to follow reimbursement. And this is one area where reimbursement is changing in a favorable way towards telehealth.
I read in the AMA Journal of Ethics that there are significant privacy and security risks in telehealth systems. What kind of risks?
Yeah, so I think, there's not, in a lot of ways, telehealth is the Wild West. I think that we don't know a lot about the technologies that are out there. We know that there are a lot of additional securities that are required for any sort of transfer of health information. And so that's a big concern of health systems, a big concern of patients as well. In fact, are part of our research group. We've done focus groups with patients and they've expressed that concern. So, At Michigan Medicine, when we're performing video consultations with patients, we're actually using the same technology that we use to send patients results and send patients messages. So there is a lot of security that's built into it, which is extraordinarily important in this era.
Is that common everywhere for places using telehealth? I mean, some kind of encryption or some other way of securing the data?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I can't speak for all institutions and all modalities, but I'll say that any company that's starting a telehealth company, that's probably number one priority for them.
What more needs to be done to make any telehealth system a usable and safe tool for patients and doctors?
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge that we face with telehealth is I think most people believe it has good potential, and I think that everyone's sort of on board with telehealth, but the biggest challenge that we face is actually in implementation. So implementation involves implementing telehealth involves changing physician workflow. It involves acceptance from patients. So there's a lot of challenges on that side. And and it's the same types of challenges that you run with implementing any sort of new clinical innovation or some new guideline. And so it involves dissemination, education, practice, rework, redesign, those types of elements.
How long before it is option A?
I'd give it 5 years.
5 years?
Yeah, I really think so. In the last five years, there's probably been more momentum for telehealth than there has been in the last 20 years. At our health system, particularly, it's one of our biggest strategic goals is to expand the use of telehealth. So I would estimate that within 5 years, it's not going to be fully integrated into our care, but I'm assuming that at least one of your doctors that you see will offer it as an option for you.
Chad Elimudel is the director of telehealth for the urology department at the University of Michigan. He's also, of course, a urologist and an assistant professor and member of the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. Did I forget get all your titles?
You got them.
Thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, does putting up solar panels on your house and buying an electric car truly help fight global climate change? Our next guest says, think again.
Buy an electric car? I can now thump my chest, I am virtuous, I've addressed the problem, I'm living the good life, and it's you bad people that are driving the SUV. If you drove an electric, the world would be a wonderful place, and it's not going to work that way.
Author of Climate Change and Our Emerging Cultural Shift, Andrew Hoffman, joins us after the break. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. You know, we all want to fix a problem, and we come up with a plan, and we come up with the tools, and we get to work. But what if the problem we need to fix is us? I recently read an article about climate change, which challenged my thinking about what needs to be done to curtail the greenhouse gas emissions causing global heating. The title of the piece in Behavioral Scientist is Climate Change and Our Emerging Cultural Shift. The author is Andrew Hoffman, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, it's good to be here.
All right. You write, you give talks about attitudes about climate change. And in this piece you wrote, you mentioned you get a lot of hate mail and angry people approaching you. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, it came after when I first started writing about this. And it was funny. I wrote an article in a journal you probably never heard of called Organizational Dynamics. And it came out and it did what academic journal articles do. It sits someplace and no one reads it. And then there was an analogy in there to the cultural shift around climate change being akin to the cultural shift around the abolition of slavery, recognizing that there are some distinct differences between right. the cruelty of one race against another, but there are interesting parallels. And the paper went out, put a line on my resume, do what academics do, and then the New York Times picked it up, that slavery abolition thing. And then Scientific American and Time Magazine, I'm thinking, oh, this is cool. I'm a public intellectual. And then someone emailed me and said, I see Mark Morano is taking his hits at you. And I was new to this. And I said, who's Mark Morano? And he said, he used to work for James Inhofe. He used to work for Rush Limbaugh. He has a page called climatedepot.com. I think you better go look at it. I went. The coverage of the article was entirely climate skeptics are the moral equivalent of slave owners and my email address. And the emails start pouring in.
Right. Yeah. You also had some personal encounters that you mentioned. Yeah. Tell us about one of those. And I like these because this gets to a big part of the cultural difference between academics like yourself and the religious folks who are kind of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, if you will, on this. Even if they feel that, you know, the science is correct and climate warming is happening, they can't take that back to the church because, right.
Yes or no. I mean, where I'm going in this paper is that if it connects to our religious beliefs, it will motivate action in ways that will be far more powerful.
But you're talking about trying to change somebody's dogma. We're going to get into that a little bit. But tell me about one of these experiences where you had to had somebody who basically saying, you're blaspheming my religion by claiming that the earth is warming and we're causing it and we can do something about it.
Well, A lot of my work has been around why do people reject the science of climate change? And the conclusion of this work is that for many people, the debate is not about CO2, it's not about climate models, it's about worldviews that they feel are threatened. One of the major worldviews that some people feel is threatened is their belief in God. And to me, that's so powerful to make this point, because what do we do when we're faced with someone who doesn't believe in climate change? We give them more scientific data. But if they're hearing a threat to their belief in God, you're missing the point and you're never going to get through to them.
So why is it a threat to their belief in God?
Well, so, you know, Rush Limbaugh devoted an entire episode of his show to the idea that you can't believe in God and believe in climate change at the same time, because we are not in charge out there. God is in charge out there. We live by his divine providence. And to suggest otherwise is extreme hubris. Or the millennia-old doctrine in there, right here in Ann Arbor. Someone held up a Bible in front of me in one of my talks and said, God promised Noah he would not flood the earth again. The seas cannot be rising. Or I gave a talk out towards Grand Rapids, and a woman came to me, and she was struggling because she said, you know, I believe in science, I believe in climate change, but I come from a deeply fundamentalist family, and they look at climate change through the lens of Revelations, and if Revelations brings the world to an end through fire, and climate change looks like it's going that way, maybe this is God's will, and why should we fight it? And that really speaks, particularly within academia, a lot of people are dismissive of religion. Yet, if you're going against someone's deeply held religious beliefs, or their deeply philosophical beliefs, we could be talking about the Bible or the Torah, we can also be talking about Rousseau or Locke.
Right.
You know, and that's the key. What is our conception of our place on earth, our purpose for being here? Climate change goes that deep, and the broader issue goes that deep, which is the Anthropocene.
Which, yeah, we need to explain that.
Yeah.
And I'll get to it, I promise.
I was careful not to put that in the title because that was just going to scare people away.
So as I mentioned, when we're faced with a problem, we want to get our tools to fix it. And in the case of climate change, you know, our tools are windmills and solar panels. Yeah. And tech can fix this, can't it?
It can address symptoms. It won't address the problem. The Tesla is a great car, but it's still a car. And the answer is not more cars. The answer is thinking differently about mobility. The answer comes down to a deep shift in our culture, which the point I make in the paper is on a scale akin to the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution or the Protestant Reformation. And the key to that analogy, there are several, but those were fundamental shifts in our cultural beliefs as a species, a fundamental shift in our perception of the environment, and a fundamental shift in how we saw the two connected. And importantly, those shifts took 100 years. And so when people say, you know, in all due respect to James Hansen, and I'll get attacked for this, but when he said, open the Keystone Pipeline and it's game over for the planet, that is not helpful, nor is it accurate. We can't think about this as a sprint. This is a marathon. I believe in the paper, the shift has begun. And it's begun in some hard to see, perhaps even imperceptible ways, but it has begun. And there's a quote I love from William Gibson. He says that the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed.
Right. Yeah.
And so there are shifts occurring, but many people did not know the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution were happening at the time. Those terms very often were coined years after, centuries after, by historians trying to make sense out of this period of tumult. So we may not know what's happening right now.
You're talking about a re-enlightenment.
A re-enlightenment. And I, you know, I've gotten blowback on using that term because a lot of people look at enlightenment as having a lot of political baggage because they see that as the beginning of colonialism, white man's burden, and that's not what I'm trying to say here. But I do think the analogy is apropos because it's that big. Aldo Leopold, who was an ecologist at the University of Wisconsin, he wrote, "No important change in ethics was ever accomplished without an internal change in our intellectual emphasis, loyalties, affections, and convictions. The proof that conservation has not yet touched these foundations of conduct lies in the fact that philosophy and religion have not yet heard of it. In our attempt to make conservation easy, we have made it trivial." And I look at climate change right now, and in an attempt to make climate change easy, we have made it trivial. Buy an electric car, I can now thump my chest, I am virtuous, I've addressed the problem, I'm living the good life, and it's you bad people that are driving the SUV. If you drove an electric, the world will be a wonderful place, and it's not going to work that way.
So you're asking us for life changes that some people will see as sacrifice. Yep. So how is that going to win friends and influence people?
I'm just pointing out the obvious reality. I'm not here to win friends and influence people.
And we should point out, you're not just talking about climate change, but you're talking about a lot of the different things that are contributing to a really dire situation for this planet and for the human race.
But, and we're talking about a culture change that, you know, humans are quite adaptive. I mentioned J.B. McKinnon's book, The Once and Future World, where he points out that we're born into a world, we take it for granted, we watch it change before our eyes, we become sad at the decay, the next generation is born into a world they accept, and then they watch it, and that cycle repeats itself. But the bigger issue here, and if I can rephrase the climate change question into a cultural question, do you believe that we as a species have grown to such numbers and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? If you answer yes, that's a huge cultural shift. It's huge. And the idea that we merely need to buy an electric car and live our lives as we always have, that's not going to happen. Now, is it sacrifice or is it just adaptation? We live lives right now that people 100 years ago would find appalling. I love to point out that when Graham Bell started putting up telephone poles, people were really offended. They were cutting them down. There were mayors around the country saying, cut those poles down. He hired Pinkerton guards to protect the poles. Now we take them for granted. Is that a sacrifice? I don't think so. And so where are we going with mobility, with the electric grid, with food? There are changes. They're happening around us right now. And that's where I see the enlightenment taking place, the re-enlightenment taking place.
So what you're talking about is a little hard to get your arms around. So I'm going to use a different metaphor here. What kind of lens should we be looking through to enable us to see what you're talking about?
Well, to begin with, is just recognizing that this is much bigger and much deeper. The answer is not going to, I mean, the market is expedient. If I put a price on this, if I put a price on carbon, it's an important step. The culture will shift with that. They go hand in hand. Anthony Giddens wrote about structuration theory, that culture and technology are in like this spiral. And as we change technology, it changes culture in ways very often we didn't anticipate. The birth control pill brings about the sexual revolution, and it continues. The cotton gin, in many ways, made the Civil War possible because slavery was dying under its own weight. The printing press created the Reformation. And so recognition of the Anthropocene. And it's more than climate change. It's species extinction. It's nitrogen runoff.
I was going to say, define what Anthropocene means.
So the Anthropocene is, geophysical scientists have argued that we've left the Holocene, we've entered the Anthropocene, we've entered a new geological epoch. This is not a philosophical statement. They actually have to do it through the geological strata on the Earth. So the way I like to describe it, if we died as a species today, in 1,000 years from now, archaeologists start digging, they will hit a layer. And they'll say, what happened here? What happened here is humans. They'll find radioactive isotopes. That's important because when they made the proposal that we're in the Anthropocene, they have to define something they call the golden spike. It's an actual place where we can actually show you the geological strata change. They're putting the golden spike at the first atomic bomb because that just spread radioactive isotopes around the Earth. And so now it's going through formal approval. But within the Anthropocene, they define 9 planetary boundaries, the boundaries we should not cross if we want to maintain a stable living environment for humans and other life forms. And one is in retreat, ozone depletion. 3 of them we're crossing. Climate change, nitrogen. We produce more nitrogens than natural processes. We put it in farms. We know this in Michigan, the algae blooms, the dead zone in the Mississippi River, and species extinction. Scientists say we're in the middle of a sixth mass extinction.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the Anthropocene. And sometimes you need to hear it in a way that just really shocks you into, oh, wait, something's weird here, because we take things for granted. Like here in Michigan, we take for granted you can't eat fish out of the lakes because of mercury and other kinds of pollution. We take that for granted.
I'm actually surprised when I talk to people that they don't realize that there are places in this state where there's DDT in the fish at a level that we can't eat the fish. Yeah. We've got PCBs, we've got dioxins, now we've got PFAS that we know about, and many other chemicals in fish at high enough levels that you either should not eat it at all, or you should limit your intake to maybe 1 or 2 fish a month.
And if you're a pregnant woman, don't even go near it. And we take that for granted.
Yeah, that's normal now.
Yeah. And I put it in the paper. I was talking to a research chemist at a pharmaceutical company, and he said very matter-of-factly, he said, you know, there's measurable levels of ibuprofen in the Mediterranean Sea. And I was like, Whoa. And he said, hey, that doesn't concern us. It's a fairly benign compound. What worries us is birth control pills and antidepressants. You take a drug, pass through your system, treatment plant can't handle it, enters the aquatic ecosystem, changes the flora and the fauna.
Yeah, my colleague Rebecca Williams has reported on this a few times. It's happening here. We can detect those pharmaceuticals in the water in Michigan.
Biologists were looking at salmon in Puget Sound 2 years ago, and they found Prozac. They found 40 prescription drugs. They even found cocaine. And guess what? That salmon's ending up on your restaurant dinner plate. And that's the Anthropocene.
And who knows what kind of impact it's having on the evolution of fish and amphibians and reptiles.
And we haven't even talked about plastics. I mean, scientists predict that by 2050, believe it or not, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish by weight. And you need these kind of statistics to say, holy smokes, what's going on? Yet we'll get numb to that too. Yeah, we'll just sort of accept that.
I thought when the study came out that showed microplastics in bottled water, in tap water, in beer, that there would be this huge outrage. But apparently, everybody feels like, well it's going to be filtered out. I mean, it's just not going to be a problem. All right, so we've talked about this huge, huge shift, a planetary shift. How can you even begin to make a paradigm shift of this magnitude in people's culture?
What I'm saying in the paper is religion is key here. So we started talking about hate mail and religion is the obstacle. And I'm saying religion is a solution and philosophy is a solution. My argument does not leave out secular humanists. You don't have to believe in God, but it comes down to our fundamental belief about why are we here? It is really existential questions. And
are we here to dominate or are we here to be good stewards?
Right. And so I fixated on Pope Francis's encyclical letter, Laudato Si. And I think it's an interesting document for really laying out a set of moral beliefs that we are. He doesn't use the word Anthropocene, but he is pointing out that we are starting to live in a world that is not very nice. We are damaging it. I love in the Catholic Catechism where they say pollution is actually theft from future generations. This is the beginning of really starting to examine some deeper questions around, well, if climate change is real, what does it mean for me mowing my lawn in Ann Arbor? That has impact for people in low-lying areas of Bangladesh. Now we're going to start to have a very serious conversation. How do you talk to people in small island states who are starting to look at the end of their habitable environment? And they didn't even do it. I mean, that's an important element here too, is that the poor people that are getting hit by this are ones that didn't even do this. And so that really starts to get us to re-examine issues around ethics, around morals, in ways that we really haven't done, and I don't think we're fully prepared to do. But when you put it on that plane, you start to see that there's something really big here. And how can we come to terms with it? That's, again, if people hear about this from the church, the mosque, the synagogue, the temple, it connects to their deepest sense of who they are. And then get out of the way, because religion can explain, Nelson Mandela. Rationality can't. Religion can explain Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War and holding firm to the idea of keeping the Union together. Rationality does not. And I put far more hope in faith to get us through the big challenges we have than a logical calculation that the odds are in my favor.
And my prediction is you're going to get hate mail from all sides just based on this one conversation. I mean, it's people do not want to be challenged like this, but what else can you do when you're faced with the kind of things we're faced?
When I first started getting hate mail, someone gave me a quote, and I haven't been able to attribute it. They told me it was from Winston Churchill. I haven't been able to verify it, but it's a wonderful quote. It says, if you're not offending anyone, you never took a stand. And it's an important quote for any academic who wants to get into the public debate. I have many scientists who tell me, oh, my work is not political. And my answer is, if you're challenging the way people think or behave, you are by definition political, and people will push back. If they don't push back, you didn't say anything important. And so accept that as part of the domain. And there's two other quotes that I really love. I heard one from Paul Newman, of all people. He said, if you don't have enemies, you don't have character. Now, I might flop that a little bit. There are people with enemies that deserve them. But if you have character, if you're standing up for what you think is right, you will have enemies. Or another one, I heard a friend say this a couple of months ago, and I said, you got to repeat that. And he said, you only get shot at when you're over the target. All of them speak to the idea that if you're saying something important, You're challenging how people think. If you challenge how people think, they're not going to like it. But change is painful. Change is hard. And this argument in this article, it applies to all of us. Even the most liberal who's just accepted climate change lock, stock, and barrel, if you think the answer is a windmill and an electric car, you're not thinking big enough.
Andrew Hoffman is a professor at the University of Michigan with joint appointments at the Ross School of Business and the School for Environment and Sustainability. He's the author of several books, including How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, thanks, Lester. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tomorrow on Stateside, Wayne State University announced it will provide free tuition for all students who graduate from Detroit high schools.
How about this? How about if your college tuition is free?
The plan begins with all incoming freshmen at Wayne State. We'll talk about what that decision could mean for the university and the city. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.